Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Dacia Eaton of KSKA Radio, and Greg Erickson of the Alaska Budget Report. Paul, Tuesday was election day in Anchorage. Give us the overview.
It was an election fueled by anger, and even at that, only 17.4% of the city's 210,000 registered voters bothered to vote. That's not a low record, but it's getting down there. Amy Dombowski won her seat in Eagle River, and Ernie Hall's race in West Anchorage is still up for grabs. We have a write-in candidate there. Tim Steele unseated Cheryl Frasca, who was appointed in January to the Assembly. Dick Traney beat back Andy Clary. Paul Honeman, Jennifer Johnson ran unopposed, and each of them got more than 80%. The school board is kind of interesting to me. We have Betty Davis, a former state senator and a former school board member, is now back on the school board. And Eric Croft, a former legislator, is now on the school board. So they've got some legislative experience stacking up there. All the propositions passed, all the bonds passed. Anchorage voters apparently wanted to spend money and do that sort of thing. And it was, all in all, a fairly successful, if not poorly turned out, election.
Thank you for that succinct summary. Dacia, you covered the election closely. You met these candidates, interviewed them on election night and many times before that. Give us some up-close look at what you saw.
Well, I mean, the story of the night was the write-in candidate Nick Moe from West Anchorage, who went up against Ernie Hall, the assembly chair, and they were neck and neck the whole night. One would get, you know, a few points ahead, 50 points ahead, then the other, and it went back and forth, and at the end of the night, Nick Moe was only 93 votes behind Ernie Hall. And Moe got into the race, of course, because of the controversial union ordinance, AO37, and you know, he said that Ernie Hall had overseen the assembly when they voted to shut down public testimony without letting everyone speak.
That was his big point. He made that point over and over again.
Yeah, he was running on that issue. Of course, he cares about other things, but that was the main thing he was running on. And now the election commission is counting, well, they're not quite to the counting point, but they're reviewing all the ballots, the question ballots. And then next Thursday, they're going to hold a public canvas where, and you'll get a letter in the mail if you voted and there was a problem with your ballot and you have to show up and say, oh, here's how I meant to vote.
And doesn't this prove once again that when people vote their intensity, especially the unions who came out to this, came out on election day, they can make a big difference?
I suppose so.
There was only 18% of the vote, but these people were really motivated.
Yeah, especially when there's 18% of the people who vote. If you get a bunch of people out, you can make a difference. And now in that particular West Anchorage race, there are just a little over 1,000 question ballots, and I think there were 4,800, a little more than 4,800 absentee ballots. That were given out to people either on the day of the election, they could vote in-person absentee at certain locations, or they were mailed out. And I just checked with the clerk's office, and they said that the last day that you could file to do an absentee ballot was the Tuesday before the election. And Nick Moe got in about 2 weeks before. He didn't start the heavy campaigning until the week before. So it'll be interesting to see how this works out. It could really go any way.
Paul, Mayor Sullivan and his critics on and off the assembly are sparring over who came out the winner here. The I'm on top dog. What do you make of that?
I'm more worried about how the voters came out in this thing, taxpayers. I don't think Sullivan could consider this a victory, but it wasn't a loss. It was kind of a kiss your sister kind of thing. It's a he lost Cheryl Frasca on the assembly in this thing because of the anger, the turnout for this. He picked up Tim Steele. Amy Dombowski won her seat, so that's kind of a wash there. But he lost, Andy Clary lost against Dick Traney.
That's and one these of were the by sizable majorities.
Much more sizable this time out than it was the last time he ran against Dick Traney. And I think a lot of that was the anger over this AO37. I think on his part, it was a calculated gamble. I have the votes now. Somebody's going to get sacrificed. They went for it. They got AO37 passed. I suppose there were other ways to handle it. I'm not sure. But I don't know if the union's claiming victory will then explain AO 37 being passed. If the mayor's claiming victory, and then explain why he lost people on the assembly. So I don't think either side won. I think it was probably a wash in the long run.
Before the election, many people thought Nick Mo didn't have a chance at all. Talked to people around town who follow elections, municipal elections, and state elections. They thought he might get 18 to 22%, including yours truly. I talked to a Mo person right the day before the election. He said, "We're going to win." I said, "Ah, come on." But he still might win, and then it wouldn't be a wash, right?
No, it wouldn't. At that point in time, the mayor winds up with an assembly that could very easily turn around and repeal AO 37 and make his life, as I put in a column recently, the seventh circle of hell. I just don't. It will be a very miserable couple of years for the mayor if he wins. It'll be kind of fun to watch.
If his new best buddy.
His new best buddy.
That's right.
That's exactly right.
That brings up the referendum.
Yeah, let's talk about that, Dacia. Please do.
Yeah, it looks like the union leaders have filed at City Hall to hold a referendum on AO 37, which means it would go to a vote by the public. And it could go a few ways. Basically, it's a big process where they have to go gather signatures. I think it's something a little over 7,000 signatures. And it could be held as soon as the fall, but also could be the vote could be held off until the following spring, so a year from now. And it'll be interesting to see how that goes and whether they do it sooner rather than later.
Paul, you pointed out that while they can probably get the signatures fairly readily, it's probably in their interest to hold the election sooner rather than later. Explain to us why.
Well, I think what the city charter allows is they can either hold the ordinance in abeyance and schedule this election at the next election, or they can set up, I think, within 75 days, a special election. I think with the assembly majority we have now, which would probably support passing AO 37, I can't imagine why you would, with the anger still very, very real out there over this thing, why you would immediately schedule an election if, in fact, they can gather the signatures. The closer they are, I think, to this election, the more likely they are to lose a ballot on AO 37. I think a year from now, if the public has cooled down, there's still going to be anger. I think Mayor Sullivan's hurt himself with this. But a year from now, I think when tempers have cooled, and people know exactly what it's about and realize the world's not going to end, the vote might be different. At least you would get, there's enough anger, for instance, Mr. Mo is an example of that anger, and that's the anger you'd run into if you scheduled that election quickly.
Adesha, the school board spent last weekend in an uproar over the appointment and withdrawal of Thomas Corcoran. He was their selection to replace Gretchen Guess, who is leaving. Now he's out and Cameron Perez-Verdia is in. How did this happen and how did it become the subject of such a huge brouhaha?
Well, it's a good question how it happened. I believe that he was the treasurer for a particular school board member while she was running for school board, Ms. Von Imhoff. And
That's come out in the reporting?
Yes. And you have to guess that there was some connection there. Why they didn't vet him more closely, why no one realized that he was part of VECO before they hired him, it's hard to say. I think, I talked with Jeannie Mackey, the chair of the school board, the president of the school board, and she expressed regret that this had happened, and really felt badly that it had drawn bad attention to the school board.
And the timing was such that it came right after the controversy over the departure of Superintendent Browder.
Exactly, it's just
so they had two bad weekends in a row.
One stumble after another there. But now they have this new person who's in. He doesn't seem to have any controversy surrounding him. He's the head of an educational nonprofit, and he'll bring some new energy to the board. I think they're really looking at finances as they move ahead, and they were hoping to have someone who would have more financial expertise to work out all these cuts that they have to do over the next few years. This person is more of a nonprofit guy, and we'll see if he has any money management skills.
Okay. Greg Erickson in Juneau, can you hear me?
I can.
Great. Greg, you're joining us from Juneau, as we noted. Give us the latest on the progress of Governor Parnell's oil bill through the House of Representatives, his oil tax bill, I should say.
Well, it moved out of House resources. Chairman Eric Feige said in a late night meeting that he thought it would be floor ready, meaning ready to go without tinkering in House Finance. But the House Finance is, I think, intent on doing some tinkering, and they're going to, they heard it on Friday morning, and I think we'll see it on the floor fairly soon.
Okay. And what are the major changes that the House is contemplating?
Well, they one of the things that people complained about the ACES legislation that this is to replace is that it's too complicated. And Governor Parnell originally introduced a very simple bill that would roll back taxes by about $1 billion a year. That has become much, much more complicated since then. And I'd say it's just as complicated now as the ACES. So I'm not going to try to explain it all. But the main argument is about the base tax rate. The House wants it lower than the Senate bill that came over and passed the Senate. There is clearly some disagreement. House wants to be nicer to the oil companies, and the Senate is maybe not quite so nice. But it's really remarkable. There is a collective delusion down here. Incentives matter, and taxes are part of the incentive structure. So lowering taxes should increase investment and output. But the notion is that this is going to move the needle, and it's just a fantasy. The decline in oil production.
Well, wouldn't if we had Governor Parnell on this show, wouldn't he say, "Oh no, we've looked at this, we've heard from the oil companies, we know this is going to work." He's not going to say, "I'm instituting a program that's not going to work or that's delusional."
Well, that's true. But in my reporting career, I've always thought that neutrality was not the same thing as objectivity. And when you look at this objectively, you look at the research that's been done since the 1970s. Changes in severance tax rates have a very, very small difference, and we can see ahead the testimony that Senator Stedman took last year and the year before clearly indicates that it's not going to arrest the decline in the pipeline. And I just wonder how these people are going to respond to that in 2 or 3 years when it becomes clear.
One final question on the oil tax bill. The Senate was only able to pass a bill because Senator Click Bishop of Fairbanks went for the 35% and really wrapped himself around it, 35% tax rate. If he gets another tax rate from out of the House, are we going to get a real problem in the conference committee? And you might explain conference committees briefly.
Well, if the two bodies pass legislation that disagrees, the conference committee is appointed for 3 members from each side, and they sit together and they try to hash out the differences and get something that can be agreed on by both bodies, the Senate and the House. I'd be surprised if we do not end up in a conference committee. And frankly, I think I suspect that we may be in special session to finally resolve this. But Click Bishop isn't the only Senate vote that might peel off if the tax rate is lower than the 35% that the Senate wanted.
Paul, you want to add anything on the wisdom of Greg Erickson that you've heard here?
He's a very wise man.
You're going to bail out.
I'm going to bail.
Okay, let's go back to Greg. Greg, the latest on natural gas, specifically House Bill 4, which passed the House and had been the subject of not only debate, but of some hostile advertising up here in Anchorage.
Yes, I've seen that. The bill is an attempt to jumpstart a $7 billion, quote, small diameter pipeline. It's actually 36 inches in diameter, which I don't think is small. It is going to appropriate, or they're in a companion measure, going to appropriate $400 million, basically, to do a open season in which they will hope that potential shippers will come forward once they see the detailed design of this pipeline and provide enough purchase enough gas and capacity in the line to make it economic. If that doesn't happen, we will have spent $400 million on another bunch of binders that is going to sit on the shelf. The proponents of this don't buy that, but that's the way I see it. The bill is passed out of Senate resources yesterday after a couple of days of hearing over the strenuous objections of Senator Hollis French, and I think that will pass. I think it'll pass both houses.
And give us a little bit about how, if this pipeline is actually built, where it would start, where it would end, and the question I think many members of the public have is, how are we going to finance this?
Well, those are good questions. The pipeline would start on the North Slope, deliver gas to Fairbanks, and then go on down and deliver gas to South Central. It needs an anchor tenant, that is, some large consumer, like the Donlin mine has been suggested, but more likely some export consumer for LNG exports. This pipeline underwent a major shift in its design parameters last year, and it's not clear that anchor tenant is going to materialize. Without the anchor tenant, that can't be built without huge subsidies from the state. Where those will come from, you get different responses. House Speaker Mike Chenault said he'd be happy to see us invest some of the state's reserves in it. Mike Hawker, the other co-sponsor of the bill, says he doesn't want to see any state subsidies, and if it can't be built with just this $400 million pump prime from the state, then he doesn't want to see it built.
And a final thing before we get back to our other guests, who is pushing this the hardest outside the legislature? What organizations, interest groups, individuals are saying this is a good idea and telling the legislature that?
Well, it's clear that people in Fairbanks think that they're are paying prices for fuel, primarily oil, far above what people in Anchorage do, and that's not fair. And they see all this natural gas on the slope, and they just wonder why they can't get it down where they can use it. Now, there's another bill that is moving through to truck LNG down, and that has a good chance of passage, and I think that might bring some more concrete relief. But the construction industry is, of course, behind it, and South Central Gas Utilities would love to have gas available, particularly if it's subsidized by the state. So there's a coalition, and there's a fear in Anchorage that somehow they'll run out of natural gas and that this will be their sheet anchor to windward that'll protect them from having the lights go out and the furnace shut off because there's not enough gas.
Okay. Paul Jenkins, hijinks on the House floor. Fairbanks Representative Scott Kawasaki stuck his tongue out at somebody. And his jaw-dropping performance, as Dermot Cole, our colleague, called it, produced a tongue-lashing. That's also quoting Dermot Cole. Tell us more.
The Fairbanks Newsminer had an editorial this morning, and the headline is, "Political Theater, Criticism of Our Immature Legislator Was Overblown." So the hometown newspaper is not
pleased. So they're defending their quote, with immature.
Well, they slap him around with one hand and slap around the complainers with the other. He was apparently the sticking out the tongue, the pursing of the cheeks, was apparently aimed at the television. And somebody was watching the television, watching the hearing, and somehow in the picture, we've got the House Speaker. Oh, that's the end of the world. It immediately set off, oh my goodness. And the fear, according to the Newsminer anyway, from Representatives Pete Higgins, Steve Thompson, Tammy Wilson, and Doug Isaacson, it was that somehow the House Speaker would say, well, you can't do that to me, and cut off any kind of support for the bill to truck gas down the North Slope. So,
which on top of everything else, Kawasaki had voted for the bill that the speaker wanted.
Exactly. I think the Newsminer has the proper attitude on this thing. It might have been blown a little out of proportion.
Desha, I was going to ask you, it's probably not a good idea to joke around on the legislative or assembly floor. Your humor perhaps can be misinterpreted, isn't that part of your wise guy behavior?
Yeah, I'd say that's a good rule of thumb. But you also have to think about all the younger people who are coming into office. We've got this 26-year-old who may be on the assembly soon. Maybe they need to set some rules about texting, because this is going up as
that was
younger
part of
and younger people.
They're not allowed to text on the House floor, as we learned. And
right.
There's a whole debate
they're
about
what's... receive texts,
oh, they're
right?
allowed to receive them, but not send them. So you can read them, right?
I think that's what we heard.
Okay, let's get Greg Erickson here. Greg, you've seen the legislature for a long time. And noted in this case, the Rules Committee Chairman Craig Johnson of Anchorage, who is nominally in charge of deportment, was appalled. He thought it was just terrible what our friend Scott Kawasaki did. Was Kawasaki appalling, or was he just silly?
Oh, that's an easy, silly is exactly what he was. And probably mean-spirited for his colleagues to have tried to discipline him so publicly. Clearly what he did was beyond the rules, and somebody should have called him aside and said, hey, you better apologize for this. And instead they made a cause celeb out of it, and it became particularly, I thought Richard Maurer wrote a really great story in the Anchorage Daily News, in which he pointed out that there were jokes about passing gas on the floor that same evening, and Tammy Wilson claimed that it didn't have any double entendre associated with it. I mean, that's just not believable to me. So I think it was a faux pas all around.
And but on the other hand, there are very good rules why the legislature, they referred to the gentleman or gentle lady from District 22, and there are other forms of decorum that are usually enforced with good reason, and I suppose that's so they don't hit each other over the head with chairs.
Well, that's the theory, but it's kind of arcane in some ways. I mean, civility is absolutely necessary if you're going to carry on the business, and particularly when the public's watching, so it's so transparent now as it didn't used to be. Some of the things are silly that you can't refer to the other body, the Senate or the House, by name. You have to refer to it indirectly as the other body. And, you know, these are kind of quaint customs, and they don't harm anything. But rules are important, and we certainly saw an attempt to make a hay out of a very small harvest, let's say.
Yes, and the question of double entendres, I've seen them myself. One Speaker of the House, Gene Guess, was being regaled by a House member who said, "I have something very important to say, Mr. Speaker," and Guess said laconically, "I'll bet." let's see, Greg, let's stay with you. You've been closely following the Kibata as it has legislation making its way through the legislature, the Kinnick Arm Bridge Authority. What did you see?
Well, it is interesting. Last year, the House passed the Kibata authorization legislation, but it died in Senate Finance. This year, I think they may have a little more difficulty getting it through the House. It is it passed out this week from House Finance, but after Republican Representative Mia Costello from Anchorage offered an amendment in House Finance that would have required legislative approval of a financing plan for the project. The project supporters said that would simply be a deal killer, would kill the project. Ms. Costello stuck to her guns, and it came to a vote in a very unusual 5-5 tie. The amendment was defeated. But it's clear there's a number of representatives, including a majority of Republicans, who feel that the state is on the hook for a lot of money if this goes through, and it assumes the risks that are would have to if the
Greg, if I might, very briefly, how could the legislature possibly give up control of the financing of this?
Well, it would still be subject to appropriation, but
that's
basically,
what I mean. Yeah.
You, if you sign a bond covenant, you're sort of on the hook for it, and that's what would happen here. This statute sets up a reserve fund, and the state is basically promising in the statute to make it whole in case it turns out that the traffic doesn't materialize, for example, that is being counted on
okay.
to pay.
Thank you very much, Greg. Let's get back to Paul Jenkins. Paul, Governor Parnell says it's time for Alaskans to embrace smaller government, starting with the budget. He says he has a five-year plan, but are Alaskans ready for fiscal restraint of the kind Parnell advises in any form except rhetorical?
what he's suggesting is an annual decline of $25 million a year in spending, with a spending cap of $6.8 billion. He wants to do a $700 million draw over 5 years from our savings accounts. As to the question of whether Alaskans want to see government spend less money, no. I'm all for government cutting its spending, as long, of course, as it's you and not me. And I think that that's the Alaskan way. The state salute is an outstretched palm, for crying out loud. I can't believe anybody in the world wants to see reduced spending here.
And Desha, one of the things I noticed when Paul said $25 million, that's virtually the exact amount that the Anchorage School District is going to be
cut. Yeah, and you know, I think that average Alaskans are going to look at what's happening in the legislature with this Kabata project and this talk about cutting the budget.
Sticking out of the tongue.
Yeah. And the sticking out of the tongue. And think, gosh, you know, you're cutting the school funding, you're cutting these things that the communities rely on. And why would we want a Kabata when we're cutting the school district by $25 million? I don't know.
You say Kabata, I say Kabeta. In any case, we are out of time. I'll be in Fairbanks next week. See you in 2 weeks, but Alaska Edition will be right here next week in any case.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublicmedia.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.